This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is my Reason colleague, Eric Bain, who's hosting a second season of his very, very, very excellent podcast, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. The first season looked at how little understood trade policies and regulations screwed with the pricing and availability of everything from baby formula to women's underwear to frozen chicken. The new season focuses on laws and policies that screw up the supply and costs of healthcare. It debuts on Thursday, September 5th, and the first episode features billionaire Mark Cuban talking about his company Cost Plus Drugs, which sells prescription drugs directly to consumers at super low prices. I talk with Eric about that and the other episodes he has on tap. And subscribe to Why We Can't Have Nice Things wherever you listen to your podcasts. Here is the Reason interview with Eric Bain. Eric Bain, great to talk to you.
Glad to be here, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
So the second season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things is all about how little understood or, you know, kind of invisible medical regulations make everything worse when it comes to getting healthcare or even coming up with new ways of treating diseases and things like that, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the first season of this podcast, which hopefully everybody listening to this has already listened to, right? The first season was all about trade policy and similar to what you just said, right? Little understood, little known things, tariffs, other regulations that just prevent goods and services from crossing borders and some of the weird economic wonkiness that results from that. And so when my producer Hunt and I went back to the drawing board to say, all right, we want to do another season of this. What do we want to do? We want to do something a little different. And I thought, well, you know, kind of the obvious thing here is healthcare. There's actually a lot of interesting similarities there of like it's a very complicated market that people don't really understand, where consumers are oftentimes not empowered at all, really, are kind of at the mercy of these larger institutions. And there's a kind of political game that goes on of cronyism and people trying to gain an advantage, not through the market place, but through getting subsidies or rebates or limiting competition in some way. And so we started digging into some of these topics and making phone calls, getting people on to talk about it, and ultimately put together what I think is maybe not totally comprehensive, but I think a really interesting look at a variety of different laws and regulations that, as you said, make it difficult for people to access care, make it difficult for doctors to do what they're trained to do, and ultimately like drive up costs for everybody.
Yeah. And before we get into, I want to go through a couple of the specific episodes that are coming up because they're great and you have a phenomenal set of guests and topics. But, you know, how have we gotten to this point? Healthcare has always been a problem. You know, we supposedly solved it with Obamacare. And before that, there were other interventions into the marketplace. So we're going to make everything straight. America generates like all, you know, virtually all of the new treatments and most of the new drugs that come out in the world. And yet, I don't know anybody in America who is happy with, you know, with their healthcare ultimately. Or, you know, I go to the doctor and I get bills from four different agencies and I don't know when I'm being scammed or not. You know, can you give a capsule summary of how healthcare, or I don't know, over the past 60 years, how did it get to a place where nobody seems to be happy with it? Some people, there's a huge amount of money involved here, but it doesn't seem like anybody is getting exactly what they want.
Yeah, that's kind of the premise that we started with. And actually, in the first episode, Michael Cannon from the Cato Institute is one of our guests in that episode. He gets second billing because we also have Mark Cuban on in that episode. And he's kind of the, you know, the big name there. But Michael Cannon's a really smart guy. And so I asked him this question, basically the same question you just asked here. He's like, whoa, OK, how did we get to this point? And his answer is a typical libertarian answer, is that it all goes back to the creation of the income tax. And I won't explain it all the way back to that point here. But I think the other problem and the answer that we eventually get around to in that episode is that there's a ton of money in the system, as you said, and that whenever you have a market where there's a lot of money in the system, the market is going to be oriented towards serving the people who control the money. And the problem, as Cannon explains in our first episode, is that it's not consumers who ultimately control the money. If you have health insurance through your employer, it's your employer who ultimately controls that money, right? It never ends up in your pocket and you don't feel empowered to do anything with it. So even if we could have greater price signals, even if we could have a greater market in healthcare, the kind of ultimate stumbling block there is that consumers are not spending their own money. And if you don't spend your own money, you don't really care what you don't necessarily care how that money's being spent. So it's we have so much money tied up in insurance. We have so much money. I mean, government obviously funds something like 70% of all healthcare expenditures. And so there's just not the sort of pressure to keep prices down that there are.
Partly the problem, like we always say, okay, well, you know, it's because the person getting the care isn't paying directly for the care. And so the doctors or the hospitals or whatever, they pad the count because they know the direct consumer is going to matter. The direct consumer is like, oh, well, I'm not really paying for this. But then why would the insurers put up with that? Because they're the ones, you know, they're paying more than they would otherwise.
Yeah, but it's because there aren't really any strong price signals that exist anywhere within the system. So you're right. The insurers do have, they're the ones who have the incentive to try to keep prices down. But there's also just kind of a lack of competition there. There's a lack of any kind of normal market economics.
And that's partly because the government says, okay, well, these types of insurers, you know, can't compete against each other, or they have to offer certain services in every plan, no matter what.
Right. Because there's so many regulations on what can be included in a health insurance plan, and because you do have government subsidized insurance or government, you know, basically fully government funded insurance that covers so many people, that eliminates a lot of the margins where you would see competition normally existing. We don't get into too much of the insurer issue in this podcast, because I thought, kind of keeping in a vein with the first season of being about you know, supply side restrictions and trade policy, I thought, you know, look, I want to approach this question of what's wrong with American healthcare. And okay, we have to talk a little bit about who pays, because that's a big part of it. But ultimately, I want to approach people and say, look, I don't care how you think healthcare should be paid for. I don't care whether you think government should pay for all of it or whether it should all be paid out of pocket, whatever. Let's find some things that could reduce the cost that we're paying, regardless of who it is, whether it's the taxpayers or whether it's your employer or whether it's yourself. And so that's where we really focus this thing, is like, let's talk about places where there are restrictions on supply of care, restrictions on access to care, restrictions on the availability of prescription drugs, for example, and how those things end up driving up costs and harming people. And then, you know, I hope that if you were to resolve some of those problems, then the who pays for it question is a little bit easier to solve, or maybe it doesn't matter as much.
Right. So let's start with your first episode, and there's going to be an excerpt of that towards the end of this podcast, of the recent interview. You asked the question, can Mark Cuban make prescription drugs affordable again? And Mark Cuban has started a company, you know, he used to be the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. He's in movie theaters. He started out with something called what eventually became known as Broadcast.com. He is, you know, a billionaire who's very much in the public eye. And now he is pushing a company called Cost Plus Drugs. What is that? And what is he trying to do with that?
Cost Plus Drugs is sort of like a wholesaler, or like a discount marketplace for pharmaceutical drugs. Like if you go to a you go to an outlet mall, maybe that sort of thing. You're buying directly from the producers rather than going through the entire supply chain. Yeah. And so he's pushing this new idea, and he explains it in the bit of the episode that we'll play later. So I won't explain the whole thing here. But essentially, he's found a way to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. Certain drugs that he's able to buy direct from manufacturers. And the big thing that he talks about is just the transparency that this has brought to a part of the healthcare market where there really is no transparency.
So what kind of drugs is he selling? And he's acting kind of as a super pharmacy then, right? So you have a prescription and you can get the prescription filled at Cost Plus Drugs?
Right. You can get the prescription. You can go right there and buy the prescription rather than going through your own prescription drug benefit in your healthcare plan or in your Medicare or something like that. Right. Yeah. So you're paying out of pocket.
The idea is that paying out of pocket for prescription X is actually cheaper than what you would be paying with a copay and all of that other stuff that's in the background of your insurance program.
Right, because nobody actually pays the actual price for pharmaceutical drugs, right? You're paying something that has been negotiated between your insurance company and the pharmacy with a pharmacy benefit manager in between that's negotiating those two things, and then they're also negotiating the price. To try to simplify, because it is all quite complicated, to simplify it in the episode, I sort of analyze it to being like a supermarket or a grocery store. Pharmaceutical drugs are a little more complicated, right? But ultimately, it's the same sort of question of a supply chain. We play the sort of amazing, famous clip from Arrested Development about the, what could a banana possibly cost, Michael? $10, right? And it's like, you know a banana doesn't cost $10, Nick. But what you don't know is you don't know how much a banana farmer gets paid, and you don't know how many middlemen are involved, and you don't need to know the whole supply chain. We as consumers don't need to have perfect knowledge of a market. We don't even need perfect transparency. And one of the things that Mark Cuban is doing with Cost Plus Drugs is they're showing all of their prices all the way through the supply chain. This is something he talks about a lot, is how important that is. But as consumers, honestly, you don't even need to know those things.
What's a typical drug? Like, what's an example of a drug that he's selling? And it's cheaper for you to just be like, I'm using my own dollars to buy this rather than, to be honest, this is part of the confusion on my prescription plan. Some drugs are $5, some drugs are $8, and some drugs could be $100.
But yeah.
Is there an example of a drug where he shows you that this is... It's like $25.
There's many of them. In fact, I mean, people should just go to Cost. I don't want to like overplug the Cost Plus Drugs thing, but it really is quite remarkable. When you go there, there's a whole list of different illnesses, ailments, whatever it might be that you have a prescription drug to treat. And you click on one of those things and it brings up the list of drugs that they have available to that available that you may be on. And for each of them, they have the retail price and then their price, and then show you the savings right there. Right. And then there's a process to just go right through and buy it. I think what's remarkable about it is that this is the way so much of the modern world works, right? Is that you can just go to a website, click on something, see the price, immediately buy it, have it sent to you. Yeah. And that's the world of 2024 that we all live in.
Yeah, that was the world of like 2004. I just booked a hotel room via Trivago, where it listed like five different hotels and what they were offering the exact same room for.
Exactly.
Like, okay, I'll go with that one. But then you have to get your doctor, or you have the prescription, and then do you show them the prescription, or does the doctor have to call it in, or?
Yeah, they go through I'm drawing a blank on the name of the, it's not a pharmacy benefit manager, but it's a pharmacy provider, it's basically an independent pharmacy. So they have a contract with a pharmacy to actually do the dispensing and the shipping of the drugs. That's still in place. But you're buying through their service rather than buying through your insurance. That's essentially the difference.
Two questions. One, why is Cuban doing this? He's a very public billionaire. He's on Shark Tank. He's also very active on Twitter and constantly getting into fights with people like Elon Musk and whatnot. Why is he choosing to do this? And is this something that he could have done as, a scrappy entrepreneur on the way up?
That's something I ask him in the episode. And again, I'd encourage people to listen to it when it comes out, because he explains it in more detail and probably does a better job than I will here. But I asked him point blank, could you have done this as an entrepreneur? Or do you have to be a billionaire to start something like this? And he says, absolutely have to be a billionaire. There's no way in. There's no bottom floor to get in on in the drug business. It just costs too much. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, speaks to a big problem in not just in the pharmaceutical drug market, but in the healthcare markets in general. It's just become, we've raised some barriers to entry and limited competition and limited innovation and limited the people who come in with maybe new brilliant ideas just don't have enough money to get in the door, compared to other sectors, sectors that Cuban maybe has more experience with, or the sectors like tech and industry where you see, new ideas coming along all the time. And people who have good ideas are rewarded for them in the marketplace. And it seems like, as I was investigating more and more of healthcare for this podcast, I just kept coming away with the sense that, you know, that the innovators, the people who are trying to do something new and different, are being stymied at every, you know, at every turn. And that probably segues nicely right into our the second and third episodes, too, which are really about that, which are about the ways in which state level health regulations stop people from being able to offer new services.
Before we leave Cuban and Cost Plus Drugs, is he making money on this, or how do they make money? Cost Plus Drugs, is it kind of like a Walmart model where they might only be making 1% return on investment on every sale, but they have a lot of sales? Or what are they making money, or is this kind of a public service?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're making money yet. I mean, I think his I get the sense from him that the goal is ultimately to make money. This is mm-hmm. not a charity that he's running, yeah. I don't think. It's from what we talked about in the interview, it sounds to me like it's very much a if we just create this alternative, it'll yeah. be so much obviously better than what you're doing right now, than the pharmaceutical drug benefits that you're getting through your insurance, that of course you'll come do this. Like he kept referring. And I think there's also an angle here where they're trying to get, you know, government funded healthcare to purchase drugs through right. their system as well, because obviously that's a huge part of the market. So he's talked about the possible savings. There've been a number of studies done. This isn't just him talking about it either. There's been studies done by Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt University did the biggest one that I looked at before the podcast that points out that there's potentially billions of dollars in savings to be had, as much as $2 billion in savings to be had if the government were to purchase just 7 generic cancer treatment drugs at the prices that Cost Plus Drugs sells them for, rather wow. than buying them at the list price that they're currently purchasing.
I mean, these are generics because, you know, this is where it gets confusing with prescriptions. You know, a lot of drugs that are off patent and are, you know, are generic now, you know, it's already, they're like, you know, $5, $10 at a CVS or a Walmart pharmacy or things like that. Why wouldn't, you know, where is the resistance to people choosing generics or doctors prescribing them, or, you know, because it just seems like a no-brainer.
I think that's, and maybe this is the simplest, best way to explain what he's doing here, is he's doing exactly the thing you just said, that like, look, if you already have, if you're, you know, getting a prescription, you may not even know that the generic is available for $5 at CVS because your doctor's giving you a prescription for this drug and your insurance company is, you know, it's not your money, as we talked about before. So you're not really incentivized to shop around anyway. And maybe it's complicated to figure out what the price is, and it's all very confusing and scary. So what Cost Plus Drugs is doing is basically just creating a Trivago of these prescriptions, prescription drugs, generic drugs that are cheaper alternatives to what you maybe are already having. So it just lowers the cost to kind of switch to something else, or the amount of time you would have to invest to find what those savings might be. And so that's essentially what he's doing, is putting all of those alternatives in one basket, giving you a place where you can go find them. And then, you know, I think that the plan is just to let the market sort itself out. Now, there's all sorts of reasons, why we talked about earlier, you know, that people are not using their own money. And if you're not using your own money, you're not necessarily incentivized to shop around. The banana example, just to go back to that, I mean, the average price of a banana is like 49 cents in the United States right now. But if the way you paid for bananas was you bought banana insurance and then you went to the grocery store and you picked one out and you rang it up and you didn't pay anything, but then you got sent a bill a month later, and then the grocery store was negotiating the price with the supplier, and then they were going to bill you, but they were going to give rebates, and then you ended up paying $1, but the actual price was $10, you'd be getting ripped off, but you wouldn't even know that you were getting ripped off, and you wouldn't care about the price, and you wouldn't shop around. You need to know, you need to at least have some choice in a marketplace to let the price signals work. And that's I think, the goal of what he's trying to do here. I think it's a noble effort.
This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Today's episode is sponsored by The Dispatch, your source for unbiased news and commentary informed by conservative principles. Is Donald Trump really going to jail? Does Joe Biden really have what it takes for a second term? Do these questions even matter in the 2024 U.S. election? Get past the bluster and get back to the facts by joining The Dispatch. The Dispatch provides original reporting and commentary on politics, policy, and culture, and it's all informed by conservative principles. Their newsletters and podcasts offer fact-based analysis to help members make sense of the biggest domestic and international stories of the day. The Dispatch has created a home for the politically homeless and provides a needed and welcome sense of humor as their writers explain the news. Reason listeners can try an exclusive 30-day free trial membership. Just click the link in the show notes to join the Dispatch today. You've got, an episode. It's a two-parter, actually. It's about certificate of needs. This is something you've written about in the past. And you talk to a woman named Katie Chubb. She's an entrepreneur who wants to open a new birth clinic in Augusta, Georgia. What is that episode about? And what is the kind of, anti-commercial regulation that's getting in the way?
Yeah, I'm really excited about this two-part episode because, as you've mentioned, this is a topic that I'd written about before, something that I care pretty deeply about. And it's also it's a more like narrative-driven episode mm-hmm. rather than some of the other stuff we've done on this podcast in the past. So it's interesting. We talked to Katie Chubb in Georgia, Dr. Jay Singleton, who's an eye surgeon in North Carolina, and both of them have spent the last couple of years fighting against their respective state certificate of need laws. Mm-hmm. With Katie in Georgia, she's been trying to open a birthing center in Augusta. She had to drive something like 2.5 hours to a birthing center in Atlanta when she had her kid. She has three kids now. Yeah. And she's somebody who just wanted for herself alternatives that weren't available in the marketplace. If you live in Augusta, Georgia, you're going to the hospital to have your baby, or maybe you're having your baby at home. There's mm-hmm. not really any sort of third alternative there. And you're in a state where maternal health care is kind of not in great shape. It's got some of the mm-hmm. lowest ratings in the country in terms of maternal and infant health care. So she saw this need. She felt like there was a market for this alternative way to provide care for mothers and infants. And she just was unable to do it because the local hospitals refused to grant her permission, to sign off on the permission that she needed from the state.
Yeah. Explain what a certificate of need law, using your work and other things Reason has done over the years, I explain this to people and they're like, wait, what are you talking about? This can't possibly be the system, but what is a certificate of need?
Yeah, that's probably where we should have started, actually. A certificate of need law. These exist on the books in something like 26 or 27 states. And basically what they do is they allow state health bureaucrats to decide what care is needed where. You have to, if you want to offer a new medical service, if you want to open something like a birthing center, in some states, if you want to do something as simple as add hospital beds to an existing hospital, if you want to expand a psychiatric treatment facility, if you want to buy a new MRI machine for your health clinic, whatever it might be, you have to first, before you can do that, you have to go apply through the State Department of Health or through whatever, the state level health bureaucracy is to get permission to do that. There's, various justifications for why these laws exist in the first place. We could talk about those if you want. But effectively, what this usually turns out to be is a situation of regulatory capture, where you have the existing, usually hospitals, but also other large medical providers in the state, more or less, and sometimes explicitly, have veto power over whether the bureaucrats will approve new competition. So probably the best case of this, and we talk about this in the episode too, is a story that I wrote for Reason a number of years ago about a neonatal intensive care unit in Southwest Virginia. There was a hospital in Salem, Virginia that wanted to open a new neonatal intensive care unit. They didn't have one on site at the time. They wanted to build one. They were willing to do it. They were willing to spend the money. They were asking permission from the state to do it. And a hospital in Roanoke, Virginia, just down the road, had the only neonatal intensive care unit in all of Southwest Virginia and repeatedly asked the state to block this application. No. And the state repeatedly blocked it. And ultimately, an infant died at the Salem hospital that, whose life may have been saved if they had a NICU.
These laws come from? You said they're, they're in almost half the states or thereabouts. But what, give a quick history, because these were originally introduced as cost saving ideas, right? That they were going to reduce, the uselessness of redundant medical services or hospital beds.
Yeah, we talk at length about this in one of the episodes, too, with Matt Mitchell at Mercatus, who's done a lot of fantastic work on con laws over the years. And he's a resource that I've leaned on quite a bit for a long time. He explains that they actually came out of transportation policy, weirdly enough, in the 1930s. Then they were adapted into healthcare policy starting in the 50s and 60s. A few states started to put these on the books. And the idea was, as you said, the idea was that state regulators would be able, they would have better knowledge of the market than consumers and the industry would. And so they could pick and choose, well, maybe we need a hospital over here. We don't need three hospitals in this town. Yeah. We need one here and we need two over there and we need another one over there. And so noble, maybe good intentions behind that. Then Congress came along and actually mandated that every state adopt health certificate of need laws for healthcare in the late 60s or early 70s. And then just about a decade later, Congress repealed that mandate because there was already a lot of evidence that these laws were not working, that they were actually having the opposite of their intended effects. But laws tend to be really sticky, and especially when you have special interests that really like them. And in this case, hospital associations, entrenched healthcare providers, the established providers in that space really like certificate of need laws because it gives them an easy way to limit competition and to consolidate their markets. And of course, markets with little competition end up being more expensive.
You have this is kind of obligatory for a libertarian podcast about healthcare. You have an episode that looks about compensating kidney donors. This is a chestnut. Why don't kidney donors or other kind of organ donors, why can't they get direct compensation for offering, something that is life-saving to the recipient?
Yeah, we actually banned that back in the 1980s when Congress passed a law that set up the national organ donation system that we have today. They said nobody can be compensated for this. And so that's a problem. And we talked to Sally Satel from AEI about this, somebody who's actually
a recipient of kidneys as well as a medical doctor.
Recipient, yeah, exactly. Yeah. She's kind of been on all sides of this situation, and so she lays out the case for why you should compensate people. We ask, I think, the obvious question, which is like, well, wouldn't this incentivize people to sell their kidneys? And I think that's it's an interesting moral dilemma to discuss. But I think the fact of the matter is that there are something like 123,000 Americans on waiting lists to receive new kidneys right now, and we only make something like 17,000 kidney transplants in the U.S. every year. So obviously those two numbers don't line up very well. Lots of people die every year waiting for kidneys. And so if there's ways to increase the number of donated kidneys in the system or the number of people willing to donate a kidney, obviously that's the right thing to do. And I thought she made a really interesting point to me, too, that is, if you're compensating somebody for it, even if it's somebody even if it's somebody who would have donated anyway, that changes that transaction, right? She talked about the guilt that she felt upon receiving a kidney from a friend of hers, from Virginia Postrel, actually, former Reason editor-in-chief, and that because you can't compensate somebody for it, you feel like you've received this thing. There's almost like a burden. Whereas if you could pay them for it, then okay, that's just like every other transaction.
The Godfather. Like, hey, I'm doing you a favor. Not asking for anything in return, right? But what is the, are there other countries that have good kidney donation systems? I've read over the years, I have no idea if it's still true. Iran used to have supposedly like the most fully functioning kidney market.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit too. I think she said that that's changed a bit recently. I don't think that's quite the way it once was, or maybe that story is maybe a bit out of proportion. But yeah, I don't think there's any place that allows outright compensation. I think the other half of that episode too is really fascinating because we talk with Jennifer Erickson from the Federation of American Scientists, and she's somebody who's been out here pounding the pavement in DC for a couple of years talking about an issue that I had no awareness of at all until I read something about her efforts just a few months ago, where she's talking about the number of kidney donations that just don't happen, the number of kidney donors, organ donors in general who pass away and their organs are never donated. And the problem there is the monopoly government contractor that's supposed to be collecting organs from people who have signed up to donate their organs, they're just dropping the ball. They're just not doing their job. And so that's an absolute tragedy, because you've got, you know, as she puts it in the episode, like, organ donation polls better than puppies and ice cream. 95% of Americans have, positive feelings about donating their organs when they're dead. And yet the government contractors here are the ones that are failing to get those organs to people that need them.
And you mean like they're not the term, I guess, is harvesting, but they're not there when the person dies to get the organs, or they get them and then they, you know, kind of take a break or something, and by the time they show up, the organs are no good anymore?
Yeah, you hear these stories sometimes about the organs that get lost in transit from one place to another. Basically gets left behind at baggage claim at the airport, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. That happens sometimes, and those are the more high-profile cases, and obviously that speaks to the failures of logistics within this government contractor. But the bigger problem is what you also just said there, which is that people just don't show up at the hospital. So you've died, Nick Gillespie. You've agreed to be an organ donor.
On a daily basis.
But you're dead, and your next of kin are all standing around being very sad in the hospital. And in theory, someone is supposed to show up from the whatever the local contractor is and say, "Hey, Nick had agreed to donate his organs. If you sign this form, we'll take them and we'll, you know, be able to provide, you know, life-saving benefits to six other people because of this," and actually go through the process of collecting the organs. And that a lot of times just doesn't happen. In some, there's 50 different regional contractors. They all have regional monopolies. And some of them, several of them actually collect fewer than half of the, or no, I'm sorry, only six of those 50 regional monopolies collected more than half of the organs that they could have collected in the past few years. So this is a huge failure. It's a failure. It means that people who are suffering are not getting life-saving organs. And it's also a huge expense, because the U.S. government spends billions of dollars every year on dialysis for Medicare patients.
And it's
and more organs would fix that.
It disrespects the donor.
It disrespects the choice that the donor's made.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just very quickly, I mean, I'm sure you engage this. Is the idea that if you compensated people for kidneys, like, is there any reason to believe that would, you know, people would be selling, you know, essential organs in order to, you know, get a quick buck or anything like that?
Yeah, we talk about that with Sally, and her response is kind of twofold, and I think I agree with both parts of it. First is that, on one hand, like, you have to trust people to make that decision. Like, this is the ultimate libertarian answer, is like, well, if somebody decides to sell their kidney, then okay. Like, there's nobody else who should really tell you, no, don't do that. Assuming you're an adult and, you know, of sound mind, and you're able to consent to that transaction, that we should be okay with that. But then secondarily, she points out, and she explains in more detail in the episode, that, you know, this isn't going to be a spurious decision that someone makes. And there's going to be,
it's not getting a tattoo.
Yeah, of
right?
course.
At the end of a drunken night.
It's a serious surgery.
Then people don't do it that much.
Right. Yeah. You're going to sit down with your doctor and you're going to say, hey, I'd like to donate my kidney. I'd like to, you know, sell my kidney. And your doctor's going to say, all right, well, let's look at how that'll impact the rest of your life. And like, there are going to be levels of control for this. And in fact, if anything, like, again, as libertarians are well aware, anytime you bring something and put it, you know, create an actual marketplace for something, you eliminate whatever black market might exist for organs. Not that I don't think there's a tremendous one there,
but
there certainly
market.
Is one.
Yeah.
And so you would eliminate that too.
Let's talk about, you have an episode that talks about terrible telemedicine regulations.
Yeah.
This was one of the many success stories of the COVID era, that telemedicine, which had been talked about forever, you know, finally really kind of got jump-started, both in terms of people doing online therapy and oftentimes talking to therapists across state lines, or online to begin with, which almost all the therapists and people I know who see therapists are like, you know what, I'm good. I would rather talk to my therapist, you know, online rather than losing an hour or more in transit to and from. But there was also a whole host of other, kind of laws that were relaxed during COVID, because where people were sick was not necessarily where doctors were, and so it was easier to consult. What's going on with telemedicine regulation now that we're all done with COVID?
That was a huge benefit of COVID. And in a lot of places, that benefit does still exist and has persisted. I think this is in some ways similar to what we were talking about with cost plus drugs, right? Where this is just the way the modern world works. Zoom is just a part of life today. Yeah. And yet so much of the healthcare industry seems to be stuck in a kind of a backwards mentality. So our main guest in that episode is Dr. Shannon McDonald. She's a cancer specialist in Boston, and she has treated patients who live all over the country, pediatric cancer specialist, I should say. Wow. So she's treated kids, you know, from all over the country. And as anybody who's gone through cancer treatment or knows someone who's gone through cancer treatment successfully can tell you, even once you're cancer free, that's an ongoing process, right? There's always subsequent checkups. There's always more scans that need to be done. And so one of her patients is June Abel, a kid who's he's an eighth grader now. Hunt and I got to go watch him play soccer. He had, you know, he had terrible cancer when he was a little tiny little baby, and now he's playing on his you know, junior high soccer team. And that's awesome. But he lives in New Jersey because families, people move around, and people aren't always necessarily in the state where they get treated for any disease, especially when you're a kid. So the sort of ongoing follow-up treatments that he's supposed to do, the consultations that he's supposed to do with Dr. McDonald, who's in Boston, those are now technically illegal in the state of New Jersey, because New Jersey has said that doctors that are not licensed in New Jersey cannot perform telemedicine visits with patients in New Jersey. So, you know, I somewhat comically, it's not that funny, but I like to imagine the state of New Jersey like sending their like health cops after, you know, across state lines on some sort of commando mission to go like raid Dr. McDonald's office in Boston. Yeah. You know, it's really just a story about we raise these silly barriers. You know, it should make no difference where someone is located.
For consultations where obviously like a physical, like, you know, actual manipulation of the body or something is not necessary.
Well, sure, of course. So like she does proton therapy for cancer treatments. And that's something that you have to, you know, if she's treating a patient, that patient is going to come to Boston for that treatment, right? And for a period of weeks. It's the initial consultations. So she talks to us about how important that is, that like, given the rules the way they are today, June may have never gotten to the Abel family may have never gotten their kid in front of her to be treated in the first place, because they may have, that connection may never have happened. Because pre-COVID, technically some of this stuff was, you weren't supposed to do it, but doctors, there were no, you know, really, nobody was really checking. And so 12 years ago when June was being treated, that wasn't an issue. But that initial connection may not have happened. The next patient that she could maybe potentially treat and save may never get to her because of this restriction. And then there's also obviously the follow-up appointments and checks, you know, that are necessary to do too.
And so, this seems particularly insane in an era where, you know, doctors are pooling their expertise, when you're looking at things like, you know, x-rays or MRI scans and things like that, right? I mean, like, you might be the doctor and you don't really know deeply enough what to do. So, I mean, this just complicates everything, right? Because then it becomes harder to share with a doctor who's in a different jurisdiction or whatever.
Right, exactly. And she talked about how, you know, there are patients, you know, pediatric oncology, it's a relatively small network of people that do that. And so she will, you know, see a patient or see a scan from somebody and know, well, you know, I'm not the right person to treat you, but go talk to, you know, a different doctor in a different city and he'll be able to take care of you. And this is just making some of those conversations harder. I think those conversations are still happening. It's just that they're technically illegal. Like, why would we want to criminalize something, or why would we want to threaten doctors with the loss of their license? It's not a criminal thing, but why would we want to, you know, threaten doctors with the loss of their license just for doing the thing they're morally supposed to do, the thing they're ethically required to do, right? Is to treat their patients, to first do no harm. But they may have to say, no, I can't take this phone call because I don't want to lose my license.
You're a policy guy, and you know, like, how do you change? I mean, is the basic way to change this policy, which seems, you know, self-evidently ridiculous, is it to publicize? I mean, part of it is to publicize it, right? So that, you know, the more people know about this in New Jersey, certainly you would think,
yeah,
you know, like they're like, I'm not going to restrict myself. Especially, I mean, this is a state that I know well, as you do, but, you know, you've got Philadelphia and New York, you know, nearby, which have like the cities that have just fantastic medical communities. New Jersey has its own. But like, why would it? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. If you live in Newark, you're closer to New York City anyway. I mean, it's like you're
right. I mean, think about
closer.
Think about if you put up this barrier instead of being in the digital world, if it was in the real world. Imagine if you said that you can't call your, you know, you can't call somebody for work in New York if you happen to be on the other side of the Hudson River. Like you can't.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that doesn't make any sense, right? Or you can't commute across state lines to go to work.
I mean, that's effectively doctors, what this like, rule is. Who are the doctors' associations in New Jersey or the hospital? Are they the ones saying, yeah, no, we need to maintain this for whatever reason? Or is it legislators who are at odds with medical providers?
It's again, it's a case of regulatory capture, in this case legislative capture. It is the special interests, the doctors in the hospitals in New Jersey who are licensed in New Jersey, who say we don't want the competition from out-of-state doctors who, you know, okay, sure, they're maybe not licensed in New Jersey. Medical licensing is basically the same in every state. There's not like a, you know, a huge variance there. Dr. McDonald tells us that, you know, her preferred solution would be to have some sort of national licensing situation that would just allow people to cross state lines. That's fine. I would rather just get rid of the restrictions altogether.
Yeah, I
think there's a number of ways around this, but I think to your point, really just we're trying to highlight how foolish this is because it just, particularly in the Northeast, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. She's in Boston. There's what, you know, six states within 3 hours drive of Boston.
Yeah.
It just seems crazy to have rules like this that limit, limit people's access to care.
Let's talk about one more episode, which is the war on drugs. And by that, you're talking about prescription drugs. And you talk with our Reason colleague, CJ Ciaramella, who is an Adderall user, right?
Yeah, he comes out as an Adderall addict.
Let's say user. He seems to be using it mostly productively, right? What goes into that? Like he's written about how, you know, kind of government restrictions on the amount of Adderall that can be produced in a given year ends up screwing over people who are using this substance responsibly. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is our attempt to kind of close the loop and come back around to the question of pharmaceutical drugs, which is where we obviously start with Mark Cuban. As you said, we talk with CJ and some other people who have, you know, difficulty filling prescriptions, basically. And in the case of Adderall, this is because of a crackdown by the DEA they're trying to limit supplies of Adderall, trying to limit prescriptions of Adderall because they feel like it's being abused or being trafficked in some way. But he talks about how difficult that is. And for somebody who suffers from ADHD, it's, you know, for him to go through the kind of it's like he describes it as the perfect storm of regulations, because now there's like additional steps you have to go through to fill your prescription. And of course, if you're somebody who is not currently on Adderall, but needs the Adderall prescription to stay focused enough to like do the paperwork, then this is exactly the wrong way to go about it. And we also talk about, we're kind of still putting the last bits of that episode together, but we're also going to talk in there about a recent decision from the FDA on MDMA treatment for people who are suffering from PTSD. I know that's a lot of acronyms all in one, but again, it's a similar situation of it's just restricting, it's restricting the ability of people to access the drug or the substance or whatever it may be that they need to kind of go about their day successfully. And these seem to me like pretty unreasonable burdens.
One of the things that, you know, ties a lot of these, if not all of them together, is this question of the supply side of stuff. Why is the supply of kidneys or of prescription drugs or of particular types of drugs like Adderall, why are they being limited, the number of hospital beds? How did we get there? The one thing that capitalism is good at, and even, you know, the hardest core leftists will admit, is like it's good at producing so much stuff, too much stuff. How do we get people to start seeing a lot of our healthcare problems? Ultimately, it's not about cost, it's about supply. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's been the kind of the fundamental problem has been we've focused too much on cost, or maybe not even so much cost, but we've focused too much on insurance. This has been the debate for as long as I've been in.
We weren't talking about do people have care? It's do people have insurance? So if they need care, they'll be covered.
And that's been the fight for, honestly, go all the way back to the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, right? Yeah. I mean, that was the idea was let's get people enrolled in health insurance plans. Obamacare is obviously in that same vein. And that, I think, misses the focus here. Not that health insurance isn't important. Everybody should have, some catastrophic insurance at least to cover something that, would be too expensive to pay for out of pocket. But that has actually kind of made the problem worse because it's further disconnected people from the actual cost of the care they are receiving. And it's to go back to Mark Cuban's point, it's, the lack of transparency in the healthcare markets. Insurance has a lot to say about that, the way in which we pay for insurance has a lot to do with that. There's been a real lack of focus from public policy makers on the supply side issues here. And there's been more focus on insurance. And then obviously there's focus on the demand side, right? There's focus on let's subsidize insurance, let's subsidize drug purchases, let's make sure we, are always throwing money at these problems.
But also then figuring out ways to kind of ration care rather than, I mean, one of the things that I like about this series, and in particular this, is it fits in broadly with a kind of abundance agenda question of if housing is too rare or too scarce and too expensive, it's like, well, build more housing. If medical care is too expensive or too hard to get, why not build a bigger supply? And it was incredibly frustrating during the Obamacare discussions, both on the right and the left. Nobody was saying, why don't we 10x the number of medical providers and see what that does and figure out how to do that rather than come up with all of this rigmarole. And anybody, I think, who has, tried to buy an insurance plan off of one of the state level Obamacare exchanges, it's impenetrable. Mm-hmm. And an easier fix is just making it, nobody is worried about where they're going to get their next hamburger. Right.
And if you try something new and it doesn't work out, that's okay. Yeah. So much of the restrictions are, particularly when we talk about the certificate of need laws, for example, these restrictions are, if something is new or unproven, we're not going to allow it into the marketplace. It's like, well, the way you prove new technology and new innovations is by letting them out on the marketplace. Josh Windham, who's an attorney at the Institute for Justice, is one of our guests in that episode. And he makes the point right at the end that, imagine if we had a certificate of need law that covered cell phones. And, Steve Jobs brought the iPhone and had to go in front of a bunch of bureaucrats and say, well, no, this is something that people really need. And they would say, well, yeah, I don't know. The phones we have today are fine. And this looks like this is new and unproven technology. And no, well, wait a minute. No, consumers decided they needed smartphones, and people voted with their dollars to purchase smartphones. But you may have, that technology may have never gotten out of the cradle if it had to go through a similar type process. So he says that con laws basically freeze markets in amber and don't let them change and evolve. And that's fundamentally the problem you see in American healthcare is that we've, via lots of different layers of government intervention, we've prevented the market mechanisms from working. We've prevented consumers from seeing the prices that they're paying or feeling the costs of what they're getting. And all of that has kind of worked together to create a system that, going back to what you said at the very beginning, nobody seems to enjoy it. We have the most advanced medical system in the world, and yet, if you ask somebody, how was your last trip to the doctor's office, they're probably going to look at you and groan.
It could, it's good, in the end we get good care, but it could be so much better. It's insane.
It could be better and cheaper and faster.
Yeah, when I think about this, the first time that I got, I was on a high deductible, low premium plan. So I was paying out of pocket for X amount. And a doctor, this was years ago, prescribed me Lipitor, which at the time was still on patent and was the most widely prescribed drug in the world. And I was like, how much is that going to be? And he was like, I have no idea. And I was like, well, could you find out? Because I'm paying for it. And he was like, yeah, that's actually really interesting. And he had his nurse call the pharmacy and all of that. And it came back, it was going to cost like 80 or 100 bucks a month out of pocket. And he was like, oh, that's ridiculous. And then he wrote me a prescription for a generic that was like $4. And he was like, this is basically just as good. And he explained to me, sometimes, you know, the brand name drugs are better or they work in a particular way. But like, I was like, holy cow. If that kind of transaction ripples throughout the system, people get a lot more, you know, they get as good care for a lot less money, right?
And people have to ask that question. People have to do that work.
It's very hard to do, you know,
when the people don't have the incentive
they're in
to do
and they're out. And, right. and also they're like, why are you talking to me? I'm the doctor. You know, I'm like an ancient priest in Peru. You know, you have no standing to ask me questions. Let me ask as a final question, how did you get into this sort of topic, both about healthcare in particular, but then more broadly, this, you know, it's fascinating. You come back to these questions of how regulatory issues that are often, you know, they seem to be part of the woodwork are actually structuring things in ways that are, you know, not to people's benefit, but we can't see them. How did you come into this as a topic that you want to discuss?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest single influence in this like way of the way I think about the world is the law. I mean, the classic Bastiat short pamphlet that just sort of lays out basic regulatory capture and theories of economics about, you know, the way in which politics and economics interact. Public choice, basically it's proto public choice theory is what you could probably call that. Right. Anybody who hasn't read that, I'd strongly recommend it. I think it's a pretty basic libertarian piece of writing. Yeah. I remember reading that for the first time.
Where did you first come across that?
I remember reading it on a bus through Normandy when I was studying abroad in college in Normandy, France.
Okay.
I don't remember why I had it with me or why, but I remember that's where I was reading it on this long bus trip that we took from Belgium down to Normandy. It wasn't like assigned in class or anything. I think I may have picked it up through, and I think I was going to an IHS seminar that summer, so it may have been
the
like
Institute
an advanced
for
reading
Humane
that.
Studies. But they might have given it to you. How did you get interested in kind of both libertarian ideas and then journalism?
Well, I think there's actually a lot of overlap between those things, right? I find a lot of I wish there was more overlap, I should say. But I mean, I think there's a skepticism and maybe even a cynicism that comes from libertarianism about the ways in which the state works and the ways in which political leaders, you know, think and operate. And then I think that is reflected certainly in Reason's journalism and in my own journalism. And I wish it was reflected more broadly, but I think it should be reflected in journalism more broadly. My earliest connection to libertarianism was probably, I mean, I credit my father with some of this because he was a libertarian volunteered with the Montgomery County Libertarian Party when I was a kid. But then recently I was thinking, you know, he was a big fan of Bob Marley's music when I was a kid. Uh-huh. And it's not like I was not one of those high schoolers who had dreadlocks or anything like that. But from the time I was about 7 years old, I knew like the Legend album at least and a bunch of other Bob Marley stuff. And there's I Shot the Sheriff. You know, have you ever thought about that song? That is basically maybe my libertarian origin theory is that, it's not about doing violence against the police, which is what you may think if you've never looked at the lyrics closely. What that song is actually about is about a guy who's being like repeatedly harassed unnecessarily by the sheriff in this town. And then he eventually says, I'm going to leave. He gets up to try to leave town and the sheriff comes after him with a gun. And then that's the defense. The chorus of the song is that, yes, I shot the sheriff. I acted in self-defense. But I didn't shoot the deputy. Like, note, this was not violence against the police in general. I'm not advocating for, you know, it's not anarchy here. It is self-defense that, like, this one guy was trying to ruin my life. And so I acted accordingly. So it's possible that song was somehow part of my libertarian origin story, strangely enough.
That's a wonderful note to end this conversation on, and particularly the Marley version, which is, you know, obviously better than the Clapton version,
obviously,
which to
yes.
Clapton's credit, brought Marley to a bigger and bigger audience.
Sure.
So it all works out. Eric Boehm, thanks for talking.
Hey, thanks for having me.